Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM.
Welcome to this week's edition of Anchorage Edition. I'm Jill Burke, filling in for Michael Carey, who has the week off. Let's start with this week's continuing big news, the mess of the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. The oil is still flowing. BP is attempting to cap that with a large-scale dome. And the pressure is mounting to see how this will affect drilling in the Arctic, with opponents attempting to squash those plans as quickly as possible. Steve, let's start with you. Bring us up to speed from lawsuits to lots of money at risk. Mm-hmm. Where are we at right now?
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, Jill, there's this huge dome that's in the Gulf right now. It's the equivalent of a four-story building that's going to be dropped a mile into the water. It's going to be guided by submersible robots, and hopefully they can cap this and get about 85% of that oil from leaking into the Gulf. Meanwhile, there's a lot of litigation that's happening right now. Environmental groups are going to court to try and stop further offshore gas and oil and gas lease sales. There are attempts to scuttle the Shell's plans to drill in the Chukchi Sea this summer. Meanwhile, you have Shell that is sort of trying to take preemptive action. It's gone around to various lawmakers in Washington, D.C., and also with the Obama administration, trying to meet with members of the administration to try to reassure them that everything's being done to make sure that any development in the Chukchi is being done safely. Shell's message is that in the Gulf, they're drilling in 5,000 feet of water. In the Chukchi, it's maybe 150, 200 feet of water, so much different in terms of conditions. So they're just trying to reassure everybody that this lease should be allowed to move forward. This is a lease that they paid over $2 billion for in a couple of years ago, 2008. And Shell has been granted permission to proceed. And it's just hoping that it can do enough preemptive work that the Obama administration doesn't say, we want to hold off and make sure that you can actually, do this right, prove that you can do it right. They feel that they can do it right.
Yeah, Steve, there's a lot of balls being juggled with this story. I mean, part of it is damage control, as you were mm-hmm. saying. Part of it is preemption, getting ahead of the curve, if at all possible. Part of it is it's 2010. It's an even-numbered year. It's a re-election year for a lot of people. And the Obama administration is not doing this in a vacuum. They're fighting an uphill battle already in Washington, D.C. right now. And if you watch the comments from everybody affiliated with the White House, they are bound and determined to make sure this is not Obama's Katrina. That's a meme that's already started to filter into the news media out there. And every single person to a man will start out their comment about this by saying, from day one, we. From day one, mm-hmm. we. From day one. That is their talking point. And I think there is a lot to be said about what the lobbying is going on in Washington, D.C. This letter comes out today, being Friday, from the Department of Interior saying that, listen, Shell, we are treading on dangerous ground. We need you guys to reevaluate. Get us a piece of paper by May 18th, mm-hmm. and let us know that you've got all your ducks in a row. Mm-hmm. Shell, of course, is thinking, if there ever was going to be excessive scrutiny, we're ready for it. That's what they're telling me this morning. So bring it, and we will do everything we can. I mean, it is such high stakes, $2 billion worth of investment.
Right, and Shell has actually said that they're up to $3.5 billion of investment on the entire project, mm-hmm. $77 million of which has already been expended this year alone, another $55 million of which is expected to occur mm-hmm. as the project moves forward. And they're saying, look, we're at the go point. We are going to lose that money outright, mm-hmm. and any further delays just drive that number up astronomically of unrecovered dollars. So it's interesting that the permits are being challenged on two fronts. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is challenging the general exploration permit, saying, look, we don't have that the MMS didn't do due diligence, didn't mm-hmm. review the dangers posed by the exploratory activities strictly enough. And then also this new drilling permit that it still needs in addition to that exploratory permit to actually put the drill into the water is now on hold mm-hmm. until the Obama administration is satisfied that this can be done safely and responsibly. So it's mm-hmm. the pressure's building for sure.
And there is a call right now to delay this another year. They're just saying, well, several environmental groups are saying, just delay it another year. It's not going to hurt anything. But as you said, there's a huge monetary penalty that Shell's going to have to pay out here. A lot of it is they want to make sure that they can shut these wells down in case of another mishap like we've had here in the Gulf. Can they shut these things down in an emergency? That didn't work well in the Gulf, and Shell again will have to demonstrate that it can respond to an emergency in the Chukchi.
And BP is fighting a two-front war at this point because we have two congressmen in Washington, D.C. who wrote a letter in January 14th, Waxman and Stupak sent a letter to Shell Alaska, not Shell Houston, saying, we've been watching your behavior up on the North Slope, and you need to promise us that your cost-cutting maneuvers are not costing safety. And then, lo and behold, well, I don't know where the fingerprints came from on this, but we see this letter surface this week in various media accounts. And BP's been on the defense of these two men are trying to establish a pattern of behavior, whether or not it's apples to oranges. And we even had Senator Begich come on my program this week and say, let's tell these two guys to come to Alaska first, and then we'll start to listen to them because we do things a little bit differently up here. It's been a very busy week.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of the whole conditions in the Arctic, you know, polar bears, impacted threatened species, are one of the items that the environmentalists are challenging. We have new information this week about designating key areas of the Arctic as critical habitat for the now threatened polar bear. And Kyle, you have some information on what we've learned there.
Well, it sounds like just before the show, I just happened to be looking at the latest on the critical habitat proposal. You know, what had happened with that? It got proposed in the fall. Where does that stand? And it looks like Fish and Wildlife put out a draft economic impact statement that said, here's how much it would cost the industry, the oil and gas industry, if we were to designate critical habitat up there on the Arctic, and it wouldn't really cost anything. They're claiming. They're saying it would cost like $500,000 over 30 years, maybe $50,000 a year. And I just saw that a few minutes before I came in. So, but it looked like what they were saying was that there's so many protections for polar bears anyway. They're listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. They're protected under the Marine Mammals Protection Act. You know, you can't hunt them. That this additional protection wouldn't affect the industry that much, which would like to hear what the industry says about that. And also kind of begs the question, then, what does it do? If it doesn't change anything, what does that?
That's the good behind it.
Right.
Right.
Why do it?
Like another layer of bureaucracy, just making sure that the various entities are talking to each other to mm-hmm. make sure that these plans are handled correctly. But I think it is interesting, that finding, you know, that we heard from industry, we heard from communities up on the North Slope that this was, you know, the sky would be falling, that it would absolutely pull the plug on economic viability for those communities because it would make exploration and development so challenging, potentially, for the companies that want to go out there, that they'd just be deterred and leave them with a bad taste.
And between this cost debate and the cost of the healthcare reform challenge, I mean, we saw that slip from $100,000 to $5,000. You kind of wish there was a voice of God here just to clear out the smoke.
Mm-hmm. Kyle, I want to stay with you. Speaking of polar bears and climate change and sea ice, that's impacting the Arctic in unique ways, as we all know, but that is also leading to some unique jobs and employment on the North Slope. Only in Alaska, polar bear patrols.
Right, yeah, well, presumably, right? I mean, maybe there's someone in Siberia who's doing this, doing
right.
the same thing. And you know, I did a fairly narrow story that was kind of the news there was that, again, the feds had, because polar bears had been listed as threatened, you know, apparently what that triggers is then they have to write some guidelines that say, all right, polar bears are threatened, so you can't be killing polar bears, and polar bears are dangerous, so we don't want them killing you. So here's like some just kind of general guidelines for how you should deal with polar bears if you live or work in polar bear country. And so they published some common sense guidelines. There's like a 30-day comment period that's going on right now, and I don't know that anyone's really speaking out against the guidelines. They're pretty common sense, and they're not real aggressive. They don't even speak to things like kind of shooting off guns to scare them away and stuff. And to tell the story, I called Kaktovik because they have if there's one place in Alaska that deals a lot with polar bears, it's Kaktovik, where during the whaling season, the whales are not that far from town, so the polar bears come and they're close to the people. And so there are people who have this job in the village, at least when there's funding for it, to just drive, like literally just drive around town in a pickup truck, and they've got their shotgun. And I talked to a girl who's, she just turned 25 years old, and she makes like $16 or $18 an hour and just kind of listens to rap music on her iPhone as she drives around town. And kind of, you know, if there's a polar bear, she goes and, you know, guns the engine, or she shoots what are called cracker shells from mm-hmm. her shotgun to scare it off. And you know, I thought that was fairly unique until one of my bosses at the paper showed me a newspaper story from 1993. You know, and there was a guy doing that exact same thing, you know, 20 years ago. So that's a fairly established job, apparently.
But without the hardcore rap hip hop on an iPhone, yeah.
Presumably.
Right, and I do think they do it in Russia, but I mean, I think the logic is, right, that the receding sea ice makes foraging for food more difficult. Mm-hmm. Bears are going to go where the food stores are, and if they're in cities and villages, increasingly they're going to be showing up where those activities take place.
I think what was different about, you know, kind of this job in 2010 or 2009, because she was doing it last fall, is that, you know, just over a few years, she noticed a real difference in terms of how bold the bears are, how many bears there are, how often they're coming into town. And, you know, there could be a lot of reasons for that, including kind of the proximity of the whales and stuff. But there also, it could also be that, you know, the bears don't have places to go. And that's what they're saying in Barrow as well. In Barrow, the bears aren't coming into town as much because they've moved the whales farther from town, apparently. But they're seeing more cases, just anecdotally seeing more cases of bears kind of being stranded because of this unpredictable sea ice. You know, you've got permanent ice that doesn't return. You've got unpredictable sea ice that goes out when it's not expected to, and you get bears that are stuck next to people.
I know
when you're talking about moving the whales, you're talking about the carcasses of whales that they've captured out there in the Beaufort and dragged on shore to clean up and stuff like that. They come up and eat the remains, right?
Right, right. The kind of the spoilings of whaling season.
Well, Churchill, Manitoba is another big place, though, where you've got people who are on constant patrol looking out for polar bears because they built Churchill in the migratory path of the polar bears as they're moving around through Manitoba there. So you get a lot of those guys in town. So I'm sure there's some jobs to be had there if you have some experience like they do now up in Kektovik.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to switch topics again. Stay on, Kyle, but again, everybody feel free to jump in here. The village of Bethel has been dealing with its liquor laws, which are never easy. They're controversial, and it's pretty tricky. They just had another vote. Bring us up to speed on where they're at.
There's been a series of votes in Bethel over the past 7 months, I guess. They voted. This is a community, the largest hub in rural Alaska. It's a kind of a shipping and shopping hub for the YK Delta. And it's been damp for 30 years, meaning that you can't, there's no liquor stores, there's no bars in town, but you can ship in a limited amount of alcohol each month. And so they voted in October to lift those restrictions to technically go wet. So you can ship as much, you know, if I live in Bethel, I can order as much alcohol as I want. I can, no one's kind of keeping track of how much liquor I'm ordering. Whereas before there was a state database that actually, you know, when you would order from Anchorage, they would keep an eye on you and know how much you were ordering. And that that didn't sit well with a lot of people in Bethel. The people who pushed for this change were just felt like there was this kind of onerous, you know, unnecessary oversight, that the rules were always being changed on them, and they never got to vote on, you know, how the state handles damp communities. And they also were super upset about a proposal that actually never went anywhere, but it was but Sarah Palin championed it, kind of, you know, that was one of her priorities, at least for a month or so, was to cut in half how much liquor you could ship to these damp communities. And so they voted to go wet, and then kind of immediately there was a lot of second guessing. People were kind of wondering, well, you know, what does this mean? Are we gonna have liquor stores and bars? Because there was this assumption that it would never happen, that that the city would fight against everyone who applied for a liquor license. And it turns out that they were right. You know, people applied for liquor licenses and they couldn't get them. You know, there was another vote that came in January where people voted to just kind of make it clear, saying, we don't want liquor stores, we don't want bars, we don't even want restaurants selling beer and wine. And then that led to this vote on Tuesday, which was an attempt, another petition, to once again restrict liquor sales in the city, to once again go damp. And that failed. The final results were reported by the city today, and it failed 57-43%. You know, it wasn't even close, and the turnout was pretty big. More people turned out for this vote than turned out back in October for the original vote to go wet. And that was like, you know, that was a city council vote. I mean, there was lots of other stuff on the ballot that time. So this clearly was a big deal in Bethel, and people kind of once again just kind of reiterated that they want to stay, that they don't want these state restrictions. And it just kind of remains to be seen about whether or not anyone will ever be able to successfully get a liquor license in
the city. Kyle, to what extent, though, is this a failure just to use the Cool Hand Luke line, a failure to communicate. I mean, they put this on the docket. They put this on the ballot back in October, and then immediately when the vote went through, the city council and the people in the town said, I'm not sure that people really understood what they were exactly voting for. Is it possible that this could have been obviated by just having a more clearly put question? Where instead of, do you want to go the A or B, black or white, but this would be the repercussions of your yes vote or no vote?
Yeah, I mean, the language has never been that clear on any of the ballots. It's talking about local option. Like, it's not like there's a box for wet and a box for damp, you know, and even using those words, the people who wanted to go wet, they don't appreciate that because they say, well, we're not really wet because we don't have local liquor sales. Mm-hmm. That was immediately people were saying that. And I heard that in my reporting a lot afterwards. But at this point, you got to wonder. I mean, this has been something that's been talked about for decades in Bethel and then really talked about for like the last 6 months. At some point, you just have to think, this has been hashed out so much in the community that people must kind of know the nuances by now, or at least the people who are going to the voting booth.
Yeah, I'm sure that's what they've been talking about nonstop. One good thing I see out of the whole thing is that it was a wide margin of victory, I guess, no matter how you feel about the issue, whether you want them to go damp or go wet. At least it was a wide margin. So many times in villages out there, it'll be just a percentage point or two, and the folks who lose come right back with another petition drive, and it may go back the other way because it's so close. And it just keeps going like a ping pong game, back and forth. So this maybe will allow people to catch their breaths and work out all the intricacies. And
likely not the final chapter.
No, definitely so, won't be.
Matt, there's a big PR campaign underway from the census about why it's good to stand up and be counted and participate. But Alaskans have joined a class action lawsuit saying things aren't working quite so well. What's the problem? And from your perspective, do the claims have merit?
I came across an editorial in a newspaper back east about a month ago that it said no good reason given. And it basically said that the Census Bureau is discriminatory when it is using the bluntest of blunt tools to filter out potential employees. And if you think about it, in these dire economic times, a part-time job like the census is a good job to have. And it turns out that they, understandably, they do a background check on everybody who applies to knock on doors. You do not want a convicted rapist. You do not want a hardened criminal knocking on doors. That is their argument. Unfortunately, they're also getting people flagged and turned down. A grandmother in Philadelphia who forged a check in the 80s, who has become like a community member. She runs the polls in every year's election. She's fine. She's got great grandkids. And another gentleman who also was filtered out. I think the basis of this argument is minorities are singled out unfairly, statistically, due to a number of reasons across the country. And if they get arrested, if they get pulled over for any violation, that'll turn up on their record. And there is such a wide berth given to the criminal justice information system. They're located in West Virginia. They give the ultimate yes or no. And I sat down with the census deputy director who visited town last week, and I might be violating some confidences, but he told me on camera, he's like, we don't want people who have these hardened pasts knocking on doors. And then off camera, he says, I'm glad I'm not the one who makes those calls, though, because there is something not so clinical about how they are deciding who can go and who can't. So, and the funny thing is, after I report on this story, we have feedback from Alaska Natives who say, listen, I was wondering why I haven't heard back. So I think that this is, and I also want to be exact, it is a class action complaint right now. Okay. On behalf of people across the country, but there's about 7 or 8 different groups that are legal groups, interest groups that are pushing this. So it is national, it is a big deal, and it is apparently something that could be turning away Alaska Natives. The problem is awareness, and the problem is that they don't know that there is a problem with their record, so we were just raising the question.
So it's an employment discrimination
complaint,
essentially. Mm-hmm. I'm going to jump to Kyle and Steve here. We have another story that's taken place locally. Troopers are trying to solve this mystery of this woman's body who was discovered when a dog came home with this skull. And so how does that happen? What do we know about it? Who is this person? And how does someone go missing without family or friends sending up alarm bells?
Well, the young woman is Danae Knox, or Box, I think is her last name. I'm sorry. I think it's Danae Box. She's 22. Her body was found last Friday up in the Houston area. Her family says that they had filed missing persons reports when she failed to show up for Thanksgiving dinner. So the family certainly seemed alarmed about this and was actively searching for her as well.
And the family's local, the family's out of state, where's the family?
I'm not real sure, not really clear on that one. I think there are certainly some local family members here up in the valley. They certainly have been concerned about her. The troopers, at least first report, said, you know, we hadn't received anything at all. So there seems to be a difference of opinion there. As for how she goes missing for that length of time, you know, it's a big territory, and unfortunately, some of these horrible things do indeed happen. We had a situation not long ago that occurred on the Kenai Peninsula, where a young woman who'd been missing for a long time, much longer time than Danae had been, same circumstances with some of her remains showing up in someone's driveway, and that alerted police to her other remains, and they're still searching for her killer. They discovered foul play in that one as well. This one, I don't think they've been able to rule one way or another if she died as a result of foul play. But yeah, it's one of those things that happen in Alaska, unfortunately, from time to time, where people do go missing for a long period of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I worked on this, it was before she was identified. It was over the weekend, and for one thing, at the time, because that's the question everyone was asking, is what are the missing people in the area? And at the time, the answer was, I don't know. Everyone you'd ask, you know, from troopers and kind of everyone, I don't know if there's, you know. And it was only suspected that this was a woman at the time, kind of based on the police officer who actually went out there and, you know, found the, saw the skull that the dog brought up to the lady's house. And, but it's this subdivision off kind of one of the main roads in Houston. And apparently there's like some trailers. There's maybe a camper on this land, but no one lives there full time. No one has for a long time. I talked to the landowners in Arkansas, and they're like, "Yeah, we haven't been up there for years." Like the wife said, she hasn't been there since like 2004. The husband would come up and like work on a house that I think the mayor actually lives in in the lot next door or whatever. But they're saying, "Look, we're never around there. We're kind of clueless as to what to happen." I mean, at that time, troopers hadn't even talked to him. They just kind of heard from friends that a body had been found on their property. And other people in the area, the same story. It's just kind of like, I don't know. You know, no one knew of any missing people, right? And nobody knew why the body would have been there for, you know, maybe like 2 years. The officer said it seemed to him like a summer or maybe two summers that the body had been there.
Wow.
Yeah, again, big territory. People kind of tend to, when they get out, they want to be left alone, keep to themselves. It's surprising, but yet it's not surprising.
It happens.
It does. It's unfortunate. It truly is. We've heard, you know, lots of stories about people coming up to Alaska. They want to just drop out of society. You know, they want to be off the grid. And that, those are folks, you know, that they do that. And unfortunately, there are times when something tragic like this happens.
Okay, Kyle, real quick. You have one last story. We'll end it here on a higher note. there's no shortage of stories and about movies based on Alaska themes. You've run across one that has to do with something maybe a little different. Is this Alaska's version of Moby Dick, or what's happening?
Or Free Willy, maybe another one.
Right.
I've only mentioned this on our website, but there's a website called Deadline.com that's kind of like, apparently is like an insider, like Hollywood website, and they break a lot of these kind of, you know, what's in production, right? Who has a deal with who? And so they said that Drew Barrymore and the guy from Jim from The Office, I don't know how to say his actual name.
Krasinski,
yeah. Are going to star in a movie, maybe just called Whales, about the 1988 gray whale rescue near Barrow. And that's all I know about it, really, except I did check in with the film office because, you know, there's the Alaska Film Office, which their whole reason for existing is to get people to actually film things in Alaska. And they were non-committal but said without wanting to say anything specific, said, you know, we're cautiously optimistic that this will be filmed in Alaska in the near future.
Yeah. Let's just hope that they're not cautiously optimistic like the proposal with Ryan Reynolds, where it was Alaska, Sitka, and it turned out to be some East Coast New England town.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you, this is my day to mention Manitoba and do a shout-out to Manitoba. I don't know why. I don't know why it's worked this way. But Winnipeg, Manitoba is the other site that the film studio is considering in this. And the film studio this week happens to be in Alaska, and they're scouting out the place. One of the things that's really enticed them about this whole story is that tax credit passed by the legislature was $100 million tax credit. So they're very interested in coming up here and actually shooting up in Barrow. They haven't made a decision yet, but it should come, as you say, it should come very soon. But yeah, they're...
According to the Manitoba lobbyist, Steve McDonald.
or the Chamber of Commerce for Winnipeg. Yeah, I don't know why. I don't think I've ever mentioned Manitoba twice in the same day, let alone the same show. But yeah, that's one of the other sites. But Anchorage, or actually Barrow, is the other site.
All right, that does it. Thanks for joining us. This is this week's edition of Anchorage Edition. Have a great week.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.